Okay, this hour we're going to take your phone calls as we talk about Velikovsky's work, Venus, the captured comet, and of course, point of origin as we talk about some ancient structures too. Fascinating. We'll do it all when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Point of origin, of course, one of the works of Laird Scranton. Laird, in your work, did you come across anything about Atlantis?
Actually, in a sort of a roundabout way, I have. This really more pertains to the next book that's coming up. The Northern Scotland site.
Yeah.
There are accurate reports of details of that site that come out of the ancient Greek writers. And so if you think about Schliemann following clues in Greek writings to find Troy, and the details that are here about Northern Scotland and these Greek writings, what I learned from that is that the Greeks were telling us the truth when they talk about geography. And so that leads me to believe that there was likely truth about Atlantis also.
There's just so much we just don't know. It's amazing how we lost that knowledge.
Now, one of the ways of finding this stuff, you remember when you were, when I was in elementary school, you know, we would read a chapter in a book, and then there would be review questions at the end of the chapter.
Yeah.
And about the time I got to fourth or fifth grade, it occurred to me that the teacher's copy of the book had all the answers to the questions in the back. If you could just get a hold of that, you'd have all the answers, right? Well, the Egyptian hieroglyphic language works like that. The way these words are put together, the symbols that are used to write the word tells you what the word means. And so if you know how to interpret those the right way, and they actually give you cues in the language itself as to how to interpret each symbol, you can understand any concept you want to. And so that's one of the things that I do is I go to an Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionary to find out what a word or a concept means, and then I compare that back to Buddhism and to other cultures to make sure that I really have the right understanding of it. So it's like having the teacher's copy of the book at your disposal.
Will we ever get the answers to this?
Yeah,
anything?
I think we will. The Dogon talk about this whole ancient tradition thing. They compare it to the skins on an onion, that you peel back one and there's another one underneath it. Every time I finish writing a book, I think I've gotten to the bottom of it, and then some reference turns up and I realize there's a whole other level to it that I didn't understand. Well, I think finally with the book that I'm working on, I'm down to the base of a lot of this stuff. And there are answers there. There are definitely answers there that open possibilities for questions like, we have reports of people living 300 years in the early, the Bible talks about people living much, much longer than we did. Or we have evidence that turns up in various countries about the possibility that there were giants on the planet. Things that are really off the wall that just fall outside of our everyday experience today. But there's the potential foundation for some of this stuff.
Okay, so since you brought up the Dogon tribe, how in the heck did they know about the binary star system with Sirius before even astronomers did?
Okay, well, that's really just the tip of the iceberg of what they know. And that's the entry point. My entry point into this whole process was trying to figure that one out. Carl Sagan said they knew it. Again, Carl Sagan comes up. Carl Sagan said that they knew it because some modern visitor who had modern knowledge from telescopes of astronomy gave it to them. But if he had looked a little bit farther, he would have realized that all the words the Dogon give this stuff in are ancient Egyptian words. As a matter of fact, if you go back to ancient Egypt, we know that the goddess Isis represents Sirius. But in order to be able to say that, we sort of tacitly agree to play a game, a symbolic game, that goes, when you say goddess, I say star. So then when they tell you that Isis had a dark sister named Nephthys, it implies that the Egyptians knew that second star was there too.
But how did they know?
Well, the Dogon say the way they knew was somebody who understood this stuff told them. And so the situation ends up being as if,
all of these different cultures
were like, if you and I had the same math teacher in high school in different years, and we met at a party years later, we suddenly realized, hey, we know all the same stuff. We have all the same examples and jokes and formulas and things, not because you and I ever knew each other, but because we had the same teacher.
Yeah, but at that point, our teacher was earthbound.
Right.
I'm not so sure these visitors who gave the Dogon tribe the knowledge were.
No, I don't think they were either. And if you look at the UFO phenomenon that happens, you realize that a lot of the way these UFOs move isn't natural physics for us. There's dimensionality to it. And I think that that's part of what was going on with these teachers for the Dogon and the Buddhists, is that there was a crossover between what they define as two universes.
Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to New Orleans to kick things up. Hey, Billy, Mardi Gras time. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Super. Thank you.
This is a great show tonight. And my question is, I wanted to know if the extraterrestrial knowledge that the Egyptians had, if there's any evidence of that in any Greek, ancient Greek writings, and did it transfer to their culture?
Yes, it did. You can see it in the structure of the deities in their mythology. Athena is directly related to the goddess Neith in ancient Egypt. Has a lot of the same symbolism. There are actually things preserved with Athena that sort of got lost in Egypt, but you can see with the Dogon. Like in Dogon culture, the goddess who weaves matter has spider symbolism associated with her. You don't see that in Egypt, but you do see it in ancient Greece. And there are reports that Greek philosophers, you know, traveled to Egypt and studied there with priests for up to 20 years, which is about the amount of time it takes to acquire all this stuff, and then went back and wrote about it in Greece.
What fascinates you the most, Laird, about this, all this?
Well, as I say, because it's leading me to the foundational stuff, the question, the million-dollar question is, who is it exactly that is so invested in us that they're willing to help us out this much? And so trying to get down to the answer of that question, I had a very odd meeting one time with a woman who seems to know a lot more than we would expect her to know. The purpose of the meeting was to ask me, I spent an hour and a half with her asking me questions about my personal life. And every question she'd ask, the answer I give her back, she'd point out how that illustrated that one of these symbols or concepts that I was pursuing has related to me for a very long time. And the last question she asked me was, who did I think was responsible for this stuff? And the answer I gave her at that time was, I didn't know who, but I knew enough to guess that what would eventually tell me who. And for her, saying what will tell me who had some kind of major significance. That was enough to finish the interview. That was like a key to the thing. I then came back to my home in Albany to an email from an acquaintance I have in Australia who claims to be psychic, and she said that all of her psychic friends knew about the meeting in New York and were upset about it because I had been granted permission to study something they wanted to study.
Kind of paint us a picture for a moment, Laird, on the visitations that you and I both think happened. How did they discover us, and what made them come here?
Well, in the archaic view, it's a relationship between these two universes, and it's understood that there are routine attempts being made from the non-material side to communicate to the material side. And these attempts happen through dreams, through what look like coincidences, through the behavior of animals, through divination and things like that. And the non-material side is described as having perfect knowledge, but an inability to act because there's no, time works differently there. There's no duration of time there the way there is here. Time doesn't play out as a set of sequential events. It's like the difference between playing the songs on a CD sequentially or just having the CD and realizing you can play any song you want. So these communications boil down to a kind of a game of charades where they're able to present a clue that the person on this side either responds to or they don't. And part of my process has been learning to understand that they're accused there and respond to them.
Next up, let's go to George in Indiana. Welcome to the program. George, go ahead.
Hello, George. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Good. I got two questions for you, guests.
Okay.
And if you keep me on the phone afterwards, I think you would like to have my phone number.
All right.
Because the thing, my knowledge is unbelievable.
Okay.
Anyway,
go ahead with your questions.
Number one, does he think this planet is made up of other planets? I'm talking slam into this molten lava ball the size of Texas, you know what I mean? And does he really knows what UFOs are? I mean, they are not actually aliens. I know who they are.
Who are they? I got to ask you that.
Huh?
Who do you think they are?
Oh, do you believe in God, George?
Yes.
Okay, then you believe in Lucifer, right?
Yes. Oh, you think they're demonic. There are a lot of people who believe that.
No, it's true. And they ain't, God won't let them correspond with us. And he's running out of time. See, angels don't actually have wings.
No, they don't.
This man painted wings on angels because they was able to fly.
And they look good in pictures.
Yeah, right.
That's all. Anyways, I'm going to put you on hold. We'll get your number. We do want to probably talk to you. But do you have a quick question for Laird here?
Yeah, does he believe this planet is made up of other planets?
Well, based on what they're saying about what they've learned about these exosolar systems, there's a period of time there of millions of years where lots of collisions seem to be happening. So there seems to be potential for that to be true. And the studies that they've done of comets so far indicate that there are many different materials that form comets. So my guess is that it would be pretty common that multiple collisions happen that end up creating the rocky planets. And so, yes, maybe not made up of other planets, but made up of the results of these collisions of many different bodies.
Would you have liked to have lived during that era, Laird?
Yes, actually, if I had to pick an era besides this one to live in, I probably would have lived at around 3200 BC.
Boy, you could have come back to this program with some great information. Huh?
That seems to be the era where things are happening.
Let's go next to Sheldon, Long Island, New York. It's your turn, Sheldon. Go ahead, please.
Hello, and thank you both for putting this on the air.
Sure.
I knew Velikovsky. I was an undergraduate at Princeton, a class of 1969, and beginning in the fall of 1964, about every month or two, I attended a group called Cosmos and Kronos.
Yes.
And this was a discussion group devoted to Velikovsky's ideas. Einstein himself was a regular, but he died in 1955.
Right.
Other people who were there were Harry Hess, who was the creator of the plate tectonics theory.
Right.
Lloyd Motz, the famous astronomer. Martin Schwarzschild, one of my teachers, another famous astronomer. And at the end of these sessions, I went up and talked to Velikovsky all the time. And he was very accessible, very kind. And in fact, my mother had corresponded with him for a number of years. And I just wanted to say I've had a lifelong interest in his ideas and in his treatment, or really mistreatment. And one other thing, the building in which this took place, these Cosmos and Kronos meetings, was called Geo Hall. And on the roof of that building was a horn antenna that was one of the twin experiments, the other at Bell Labs, that discovered the 4-degree background microwave radiation from the original explosion creation of the universe.
Wow.
And I'm sure that would have delighted Velikovsky that this was in the same building as his discussion group.
Wow, that's all amazing. I know Harry Hess was a very close friend of his. There was one of Velikovsky's predictions, the one that he made, claimed that water was going to be found just beneath the surface of the moon, and that was finally too much for Harry Hess. Harry Hess finally said, look, you've gone too far with this one for me. I don't think this is going to be proved true, but a couple of years ago...
It was true. Yep. It's frozen, but it's there.
Yep.
Well, do you think Mars... Let's jump back to Velikovsky for a moment, too. Do you think Mars had inhabitants on that planet?
I think Mars had life on it. It certainly had all the potential to have life. And what it looks to me is as if the potential for life is built into the structure of the universe. And so just as any place the seed of a weed drops that is hospitable to it, it grows. And I think that life is the same thing. We're going to find the universe teeming with life.
I think so, too. I think so, too. Do you think this planet is a prison planet? It's a dump yard?
No, I don't think that's true at all. I mean, it's hard to say what has gone on in the past here and what purposes groups might have put it to, but I don't think that's true. I don't see that any of the same signs that you might see in the U.S. and Australia were dump yards for convicts from Europe.
With Göbekli Tepe, the etchings of the animals on the stones, what purpose do you think that, other than artistic, what do you think it was for?
Well, based on the way the linguistics work, it looks like it was proto-writing, that the animals pictured, the names of the animals, seem to have been also cosmological terms. And so a hunter-gatherer would walk up to a pillar and see the picture of an animal whose name he knows, and when he speaks it, he was saying the name of the concept that he might have been instructed in there.
So they had a method for their madness.
Oh, yeah. There's a method for everything, and not just a method, but almost an OCD method. They were such sticklers for consistency that helps a person like me sort out what was going on. One of the ways you tie this Göbekli Tepe stuff forward is you look at ancient Egyptian words. There are some words, that archaic word forms, that are names of mountaintop sanctuaries. The word begins with a picture of a shrine,
yeah,
and ends with a picture of mountains. And in between are listed the names of three deities. In the archaic form, the word for the region that Göbekli Tepe is in was called Get Petkai, which is not all that far from Göbekli. But when you modernize the pronunciation of the glyphs, it actually reads Het Pet Kaya. Now, Pet is an Egyptian god that cosmologically for me represents the concept of space. Ka is an Egyptian god that is traditionally seen as representing duality, but from my perspective, it represents the concept of an embrace, which is an important concept. The idea of interaction between these two universes is characterized as an embrace. And Yah is the light god of Judaism. So the name of the site says Het, which means temple, Pet Ka Yah, which is space embracing light.
Of all the books you've written to date, which one is the most fascinating for you?
The later ones are more fascinating. Well, actually, they're all fascinating in different ways. The first book was...
It's like loving your kids. You love them all the same.
Well, and there are reasons for liking them. The first book happened by accident. I was just keeping notes for myself and trying to keep them organized, and finally came to a point where I realized I had accidentally written a book, and I self-published it. The more recent books are interesting because, like the Point of Origin book...
That's a great book, by the way.
Oh, thank you. One July, a couple of years ago, I thought I was exploring a half a dozen questions for different people I knew that related to language. And on this particular morning, I came to answers to all six questions. They were all resolved by words that fell out in the same column of the same page of the Egyptian Hieroglyphic Dictionary.
Synchronicity, to be sure. Final questions next on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Charles R. Smith joins us for a few hours to talk about tensions with North Korea and how that could affect all of us, followed by Bloody Mary as she talks about voodoo. So make sure you're part of that program. And by the way, make sure you get our free daily newsletter. It's digitally sent to your computer. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com, scroll down to the bottom of the page. On the right side, click the link for Coast Zone. It's free to sign up at coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back. Laird Scranton with us. Laird, did Velikovsky die sad?
Yeah, I think he died a broken man. I think that he had had hoped that before he died, his position would be vindicated, but the science just wasn't there yet. he was persona non grata. He's sort of, his name is sort of like Voldemort in the Harry Potter series. He's the guy whose name is not spoken. And so I'm happy if the book that I wrote can help vindicate some of that.
Had he stayed away from that theory about the Venus, would he have been okay?
No, there. I mean, he wrote a number of books that all have their own levels of controversy. Worlds in Collision certainly put it over the top, but this is a guy who stuck to his principles. And the thing about Velikovsky is he and Einstein both were prone to making what I call qualitative observations. These are not quantitative; it's they didn't derive these from numbers and math. Einstein used to play thought games with himself. You know, what would happen if I were riding on a train and tossing a ball up and down? What would that tell me about physics? Well, Velikovsky was the same way. He was making conclusions based on common sense observations, and that's also the way I've approached my work. So I feel a kinship to him.
Did he ever practice his psychiatric work? He was a doctor.
Yeah, he was a psychiatrist. He practiced as a psychiatrist in Princeton as well as working at Princeton University.
I wonder if that was affected, too, because of his astronomical work.
I'm not sure. I know his daughter was a psychiatrist in Princeton, and his grandson, who I've actually been in contact with, is also a psychiatrist in Princeton.
I would have liked to have met the guy.
Yeah, I would have too.
That caller said he knew him, but when did he die?
Died in 1979.
79. A broken man. He would have been a great guest on this show.
Yes. His daughter, Ruth, published a book called The Truth Behind the Torment, and it's basically republishing all the correspondence from that Worlds in Collision era.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Scott in San Diego to get us going on this segment. Hello, Scott, go ahead.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. Honored.
Hi.
Where do I start here, please? Okay, the Bible. I'm going to jump around here. We have pyramids all over the planet on the ley lines. We have civilization coming from a desert, like thousands of square miles, sign of having ever provided life, meaning it's really old. All right, we have the royals trace their lineage back to the original tribes. Then we jump over to the Americas, where we have, you know, the most symbiotic people, the Native Americans, indigenous, not excavating any dinosaur bones or any records of having come across them, correct? And it just seems like they're able, they provide all the information that we know, right? Just about everything we know is published by the New World Order that goes back who knows how far. But this is how far, I think, is that they have, with all their tools, they have tucked away in their warehouse, underground, wherever, they have done this scenario before. They've gone from the beginning of the Bible to the close, wiped away most evidence, and then just started over with their grand experiment, their great plan, just to see what they can do and what, you know.
And how far they can take it.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, I guess the question is there a possibility of them having just run through this Bible before and they just put it away and someone picks it up again at some point after they've, you know, regrouped and enjoyed not having us around, and then just the Bible pops up again one day and someone says, hey, in the beginning.
Over and over.
It's interesting, and they just go over and over. Yes, sir.
What do you think of that, Laird?
Well, there are definitely cultures that talk about cycles. The most obvious is the Yuga cycle of the Buddhists, and the idea that that human knowledge goes through ascension and decline. And so it makes sense that as a part of that cycle, that time also might be a circle, that events may reoccur. Everything else we know in astronomy boils down to circles and orbs, basically. So I don't think it's beyond the possibility that events happen more than once. I don't have any definite proof of that, but I can see that it's a possibility.
So Velikovsky was shunned, but was he laughed at too?
Well, yes. Even today, if you talk to anybody whose primary orientation is science and you mention Velikovsky, the response is ridicule.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Try to understand that one of the deflections that the scientific community sort of evolved in response to things like UFOs was to ridicule an idea as a way of dismissing it. So Velikovsky had a period in around the time of the moon landing, around 1969, where he was sort of rehabilitated for a while. He was a commentator on TV in connection with the moon landings. And there was a symposium held in San Francisco in 1972 where he had a chance to defend some of his theories. But in the end, he didn't have the kind of reputation that I think he hoped he'd have.
Around 1500 BC, there was an eruption. Was it near Greece, wasn't it, Santorini?
The volcano of Thera on Santorini erupted. It's the largest geological eruptive period in the history of the Earth, as far as we know.
Might that have been caused by Venus?
Well, yeah, they don't have an official cause for it, and it is the sort of thing that would happen if an astronomic body made a close approach to the planet. That's a possibility. You have all sorts of other effects around the same time. You have a major fluctuation in the magnetic field of the Earth that they don't know why it happened. And a lot of the Exodus plagues, the 10 plagues of Egypt, can be explained in terms of that eruption. You saw a lot of the same effects when Mount St. Helens erupted. The downstream, certain streams, if they absorbed copper from the ash, could change color. You'd see vermin abandoning the water where they lived and moving into the areas where people were. You saw raining hot stones from the volcanic eruption. So a lot of the effects are volcanic.
Let's go to Christian in Alberta, Canada. Hello, Christian. Thanks for calling, and you're on the air. Christian? He's disappeared. Well, he was on hold so long. Let's go to Paul in Jersey City, New Jersey. How about you, Paul?
Oh, good morning, George.
Hi.
This is Scranton. I just wanted to say this is a fascinating program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But some previous guests you've had on the program have also corroborated the work of Dr. Velikovsky, James McKenney, for one, Robert Stock for another, and, of course, Michael Cremo, who
mm-hmm.
I mentioned before. So I'd just like to give some honorable mention to those gentlemen as well. The one thing in science, now I'm an engineer myself, the one thing that I really hate in the attitude is, and to me is the dirtiest word in any field of study, and that is arrogance. And that is what I often found among many fellow engineers, many scientists.
Peers, yeah.
One of them, I hate to say, and because I did not know him personally, but my brother-in-law and his father certainly did because they taught at Cornell, was Carl Sagan.
Yeah. He was a tough one.
Yeah, he was. I knew him casually from Brooklyn. He was from Bensonhurst in Brooklyn, so we were sort of neighbors, you may say. And yeah, he was just extremely arrogant, and it was his attitude was either it is my way or the highway. But he is not the only one. I do remember Dr. Velikovsky, and I felt at the time, and I still feel that the people who vilified him then were just plain arrogant, because many of the ideas and theories that they held have since been proved to be false. And in science, you have to be open. I think you would agree with me on that, Mrs. Scranton.
Right.
You must be open in science. You have to realize that you begin with a theory, experimentation, if possible, observation, and then conclusion. And unfortunately, many scientists tend to work in the opposite. They have a preset conclusion, just like religious fanatics may have, and they work backwards from that. In other words, trying to make the facts fit their theory.
Right.
In fact, I remember being in a terrific argument with a physics professor that we had who was arguing for he would constantly talk about the fact of evolution, and one of the other students was, well, more religious than I was. So see, like you, George, I'm spiritual. I'm not
right.
I'm not particularly religious. But I remember defending this student. Now I was opposed to him on his fanaticism. He was a fanatic of a Christian religion. I'll just leave it at that. And he and I had been in some discussions about it, and his attitude was also that arrogance. But the physics professor we had was just as arrogant. He said, "No, evolution is a fact." And I remember telling him this, "Sir, no, it's a theory, just as creation is a theory. We really cannot, right now, we don't have enough evidence to prove either one." And he was simply so arrogant the way he said, "Well, no, there's been so much written about it." And I said, "Well, there's so much written about mythology, too, and we don't believe in Jupiter or Hercules as gods."
That's all true.
Yeah, that was the attitude, and that still is the attitude among so many of them. And that's what I think holds back a lot of science. I mean, just one of
they're just not open-minded enough.
Exactly. And that's but that's what you want in science. That's what you need in really in anything.
The good ones, I think.
Exactly. That's maybe why I feel also that we've been visited. And when scientists argue against it, they're arguing based on what we are able to do now. Well, if you look at what we were able to do now compared to what we were able to do, say, in 1500, when the volcano erupted in Greece.
Night and day.
And I think also Japan was hit with a terrific tsunami at that time, worse than the one that hit in 2011.
In Fukushima, yeah.
Yeah, at Fukushima, yeah. It was. Now, they recorded that. This is a matter of fact. So, again, how do we explain this? Well, we, as you did, Mr. Scranton, you based on what you observe and what can be discerned from what was written in the past, you can come to a possible conclusion. But again, you're not trying to say this is definitely the way it happened. This must be the way it happened. No, you're right. Saying it is possible. This is the way it happened, and that's the way it should be.
Well, the rationale for being open to the possibility of a non-human involvement, there actually is an interesting rationale for it. We have two systems of cosmology that are a match for one another today. One comes from the Dogon tribe, one comes from the Buddhists. The Buddhist one was documented by around 400 BC. The Dogon one is expressed using words that went out of use around 750 BC, but ties to evidence that looks like it's around 3000 BC. Both are legitimately ancient systems, and they're a match for one another. So, and they're given in entirely different languages. The Buddhist system's given in Sanskrit, and the Dogon system is given in Egyptian hieroglyphic words, and there's not a lot of overlap in the terminology. So it's not likely that one got it from the other. So from the perspective of a researcher like myself, I have two possible conclusions. One is that each group was able to retain all of the intimate details of their tradition down through thousands of years, but then somehow both misremembered where they got it from in the same way. Or else, they both also got that fact right, retained it correctly, and correctly remembered where they got it from. And so if you look at the question that way, you have to at least allow the possibility that it was a non-human source. But it really boils down to a moot question, because the information that's being expressed here, some of it could only be known by a space-capable culture.
Uh-huh.
So even if you got it from, even if we got it from ourselves, the implication is that we were those space aliens. We were space capable.
I just think whatever they saw, it became their gods, and that's what they wrote about. That's how they illustrated it.
And doing the comparisons is really interesting, because groups like the Dogon have retained it more as science.
That's right.
Expressed as metaphor. So you can see how what represented stages of creation for the Dogon got expressed as deities in Egypt.
Let us know when the mystery of Scarabrei is done, okay?
Oh, absolutely. It's due out in December or January.
All right, that'll be perfect timing for us. Thanks, Laird. Laird Scranton. His websites, he's got a lot of them, are all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Greg Bishop, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burleson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.